in the league. The reason small schools dominate the top 25 isn't because small schools are better, but because small schools have more variable test scores. A few child prodigies or a few third grade slackers can swing a small school's average wildly. In a large school, the effect of a few extreme scores will simply dissolve into the big average, hardly budging the overall number. So how are we supposed to know which school is best or which state is most cancer-prone if taking simple averages doesn't work? If you're an executive managing a lot of teams, how can you accurately assess performance when the smaller teams are more likely to predominate at both the top and bottom tier of your rankings? There is, unfortunately, no easy answer. If a tiny state like South Dakota experiences a rash of brain cancer, you might presume that the spike is in large measure due to luck, and you might estimate that the rate of brain cancer in the future is likely to be closer to the overall national number. You could accomplish this by taking some kind of weighted average of the South Dakota rate with the national rate. But how to weight the two numbers? That's a bit of an art involving a fair amount of technical labor I'll spare you here. One relevant fact was first observed by Abraham de Moivre, an early contributor to the modern theory of probability. De Moivre's 1756 book, The Doctrine of Chances, was one of the key texts on the subject. Even then, the popularization of mathematical advances was a vigorous industry. Edmund Hoyle, whose authority in matters of card games was so great that people still use the phrase according to Hoyle, wrote a book to help gamblers master the new theory called An Essay Towards Making the Doctrine of Chances Easy to Those Who Understand Vulgar Arithmetic Only, to which is added some useful tables on annuities. De Moivre wasn't satisfied with the law of large numbers, which said that in the long run, the proportion of heads in a sequence of flips gets closer and closer to 50%. He wanted to know how much closer. To understand what he found, let's go back and look at those coin flip counts again. But now, instead of listing the total number of heads, we're going to record the difference between the number of heads actually flipped and the number of heads you might expect, 50% of the flips. In other words, we're measuring how far off we are from perfect head-tail parity. For the 10 coin trials, you get 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 2, 2. For the 100 coin trials, 4, 4, 2, 5, 2, 1, 3, 8. And for the 1,000 coin trials, 14, 1, 11, 28, 37, 26, 8, 10, 22. You can see that the discrepancies from 50-50 get bigger in absolute terms as the number of coin flips grows, even though, as the law of large numbers demands, they're getting smaller as a proportion of the number of flips. De Moivre's insight is that the size of the typical discrepancy is governed by the square root of the number of coins you toss. Toss 100 times as many coins as before, and the typical discrepancy grows by a factor of 10, at least in absolute terms. As a proportion of the total number of tosses, the discrepancy shrinks as the number of coins grows, because the square root of the number of coins grows much more slowly than does the number of coins itself. The 1,000 coin flippers sometimes miss an even distribution by as many as 38 heads, but as a proportion of total throws, that's only 3.8% away from 50-50. De Moivre's observation is the same one that underlies the computation of the standard error in a political poll. If you want to make the error bar half as big, you need to survey four times as many people. And if you want to know how impressed to be by a good run of heads, you can ask how many square roots away from 50% it is. The square root of 100 is 10. So when I got 60 heads in 100 tries, that was exactly one square root away from 50-50. The square root of 1,000 is about 31. So when I got 538 heads in 1,000 tries, I did something even more surprising. Even though I got only 53.8% heads in the latter case and 60% heads in the former. But De Moivre wasn't done. He found that the discrepancies from 50-50 in the long run always tend to form themselves into a perfect bell curve, or, as we call it in the biz, the normal distribution. Statistics pioneer Francis Isidro Edgeworth proposed that the curve be called the gendarme's hat, and I have to say, I'm sorry this didn't catch on. The bell curve slash gendarme's hat is tall in the middle and very flat near the edges, which is to say that the farther a discrepancy is from zero, the less likely it is to be encountered. And this can be precisely quantified. If you flip n coins, the chance that you'll end up being off by at most the square root of n from 50% heads is about 95.45%. The square root of 1,000 is about 31, and indeed, 18 of our 20 big 1,000 coin trials, or 90%, were within 31 heads of 500. If I kept playing the game, the fraction of times I ended up somewhere between 469 and 531 heads would get closer and closer to that 95.45% figure. It feels like something is making it happen. Indeed, Demuave himself might have felt this way. By many accounts, he viewed the regularities in the behavior of repeated coin flips, or any other experiment subject to chance, as the work of God's hand itself, which turned the short-term irregularities of coins, dice, and human life into predictable long-term behavior governed by immutable laws and decipherable formulae. It's dangerous to feel this way. Because if you think somebody's transcendental hand, God, Lady Luck, Lakshmi, doesn't matter, is pushing the coins to come up half heads, you start to believe in the so-called law of averages, five heads in a row, and the next one's almost sure to land tails. Have three sons, and a daughter is surely up next. After all, didn't Demuave tell us that extreme outcomes like four straight sons are highly unlikely? He did, and they are. But if you've already had three sons, a fourth son is not so unlikely at all. In fact, you're just as likely to have a son as a first-time parent. This seems at first to be in conflict with the law of large numbers, which ought to be pushing your brood to be split half and half between boys and girls. But the conflict is an illusion. It's easier to see what's going on with the coins. I might start flipping and get 10 heads in a row. What happens next? Well, one thing that might happen is you'd start to suspect something was funny about the coin. We'll return to that issue in part 2, but for now, let's assume the coin is fair. So the law demands that the proportion of heads must approach 50% as I flip the coin more and more times. Common sense suggests that, at this point, tails must be slightly more likely in order to correct the existing imbalance. But common sense says, much more insistently, that the coin can't remember what happened the first 10 times I flipped it. I won't keep you in suspense. The second common sense is right. The law of averages is not very well named because laws should be true and this one is false. Coins have no memory, so the next coin you flip has a 50-50 chance of coming up heads, the same as any other. The way the overall proportion settles down to 50% isn't that fate favors tails to compensate for the heads that have already landed. It's that those first 10 flips become less and less important the more flips we make. If I flip the coin 1,000 more times and get about half heads, then the proportion of heads in the first 1,010 flips is also going to be close to 50%. That's how the law of large numbers works, not by balancing out what's already happened, but by diluting what's already happened with new data until the past is so proportionally negligible that it can safely be forgotten. Survivors. What applies to coins and test scores applies to massacres and genocides, too. If you rate your bloodshed by proportion of national population eliminated, the worst offenses will tend to be concentrated in the smallest countries. Matthew White, author of the agreeably morbid Great Big Book of Horrible Things, ranked the bloodlettings of the 20th century in this order and found that the top three were the massacre of the Herero of Namibia by their German colonists, the slaughter of Cambodians by Pol Pot, and King Leopold's war in the Congo. Hitler, Stalin, Mao, and the big populations they decimated don't make the list. This bias toward less populous nations presents a problem. Where is our mathematically certified rule for figuring out precisely how much distress to experience when we read about the deaths of people in Israel, Palestine, Nicaragua, or Spain? Here's a rule of thumb that makes sense to me. If the magnitude of a disaster is so great that it feels right to talk about survivors, then it makes sense to measure the death toll as a proportion of total population. When you talk about a survivor of the Rwandan genocide, you could be talking about any Tutsi living in Rwanda, so it makes sense to say that the genocide wiped out 75% of the Tutsi population. and you might be justified to say that a catastrophe that killed 75% of the population of Switzerland was the Swiss equivalent of what befell the Tutsi. But it would be absurd to call someone in Seattle a survivor of the World Trade Center attack. So it's probably not useful to think of deaths at the World Trade Center as a proportion of all Americans. Only about 1 in 100,000 Americans, or 0.001%, died at the World Trade Center that day. That number is too close to zero for your intuition to grasp hold of it. You have no feeling for what that proportion means. And so it's dicey to say that the Swiss equivalent to the World Trade Center attacks would be a mass murder that killed 0.001% of the Swiss, or 80 people. So how are we supposed to rank atrocities if not by absolute numbers and not by proportion? Some comparisons are clear. The Rwanda genocide was worse than 9/11, and 9/11 was worse than Columbine, and Columbine was worse than one person getting killed in a drunk driving accident. Others, separated by vast differences in time and space, are harder to compare. Was the 30 Years' War really more deadly than World War I? How does the horrifyingly rapid Rwanda genocide stack up against the long, brutal war between Iran and Iraq? Most mathematicians would say that, in the end, the disasters and atrocities of history form what we call a partially ordered set. That's a fancy way of saying that some pairs of disasters can be meaningfully compared and others cannot. This isn't because we don't have accurate enough death counts or firm enough opinions as to the relative merits of being annihilated by a bomb versus dying of war-induced famine. It's because the question of whether one war was worse than another is fundamentally unlike the question of whether one number is bigger than another. The latter question always has an answer. The former does not. And if you want to imagine what it means for 26 people to be killed by terrorist bombings, imagine 26 people killed by terrorist bombings, not halfway across the world, but in your own city. That computation is mathematically and morally unimpeachable, and no calculator is required. Chapter 5. More Pie Than Plate. Proportions can be misleading even in simpler, seemingly less ambiguous cases. A recent working paper by economists Michael Spence and Sandalay Hlachweyo painted a striking picture of job growth in the United States. It's traditional and pleasant to think of America as an industrial colossus whose factories run furiously night and day producing the goods the world demands. Contemporary reality is rather different. Between 1990 and 2008, the U.S. economy gained a net 27.3 million jobs. Of those, 26.7 million, or 98%, came from the non-tradable sector, the part of the economy including things like government, healthcare, retail, and food service, which can't be outsourced and which don't produce goods to be shipped overseas. That number tells a powerful story about recent American industrial history, and it was widely repeated, from The Economist to Bill Clinton's latest book. But you have to be careful about what it means. 98% is really, really close to 100%. So does the study say the growth is as concentrated in the non-tradable part of the economy as it could possibly be? That's what it sounds like, but that's not quite right. Jobs in the tradable sector grew by a mere 620,000 between 1990 and 2008. That's true. But it could have been worse. They could have declined. That's what happened between 2000 and 2008. The tradable sector lost about 3 million jobs, while the non-tradable sector added 7 million. So the non-tradable sector accounted for 7 million jobs out of the total gain of 4 million, or 175%. The slogan to live by here is, don't talk about percentages of numbers when the numbers might be negative. This may seem overly cautious. Negative numbers are numbers, and as such, they can be multiplied and divided like any others. But even this is not as trivial as it first appears. To our mathematical predecessors, it wasn't even clear that negative numbers were numbers at all. They do not, after all, represent quantities in exactly the same way positive numbers do. I can have 7 apples in my hand, but not -7. The great 16th century algebraists like Cardano and François Viète argued furiously about whether a negative times a negative equaled a positive, or rather, they understood that consistency seemed to demand that this be so, But there was real division about whether this had been proved factual or was only a notational expedient. Cardano, when an equation he was studying had a negative number among its solutions, had the habit of calling the offending solution ficta, or fake. The arguments of Italian Renaissance mathematicians can at times seem as recondite and irrelevant to us as their theology. But they weren't wrong that there's something about the combination of negative quantities and arithmetic operations like percentage that short-circuits one's intuition. When you disobey the slogan I gave you, all sorts of weird incongruities start to bubble up. For example, say I run a coffee shop. People, sad to say, are not buying my coffee. Last month I lost $500 on that part of my business. Fortunately, I had the prescience to install a pastry case and a CD rack, and those two operations made a $750 profit each. In all, I made $1,000 this month, and 75% of that amount came from my pastry case. Which makes it sound like the pastry case is what's really moving my business right now. Almost all my profit is croissant driven. Except that it's just as correct to say that 75% of my profits came from the CD rack. And imagine if I'd lost $1,000 more on coffee, then my total profits would be zero, infinity percent of which would be coming from pastry. 75% sounds like it means almost all, but when you're dealing with numbers that could be either positive or negative, like profits, it might mean something very different. This problem never arises when you study numbers that are constrained to be positive, like expenses, revenues, or populations. If 75% of Americans think Paul McCartney was the cutest Beatle, then it's not possible that another 75% give the nod to Ringo Starr. He, George, and John have to split the remaining 25% between them. You can see this phenomenon in the jobs data, too. Spence and Lachueo might have pointed out that about 600,000 jobs were created in finance and insurance. That's almost 100% of the total jobs created by the tradable sector as a whole. They didn't point that out because they weren't trying to trick you into believing that no other part of the economy was growing over that time span. As you might remember, there was at least one other part of the U.S. economy that added a lot of jobs between 1990 and today, the sector classified as computer systems design and related services, which tripled its job numbers, adding more than 1 million jobs all by itself. The total jobs added by finance and computers were way over the 620,000 jobs added by the tradable sector as a whole. Those gains were balanced out by big losses in manufacturing. The combination of positive and negative allows you, if you're not careful, to tell a fake story in which the whole work of job creation in the tradable sector was done by the financial industry. One can't object very much to what Spence and Lachueo wrote. It's true. The total job growth in an aggregate of hundreds of industries can be negative, but in a normal economic context, over a reasonably long time interval, it's extremely likely to be positive. The population keeps growing, after all, and absent total disaster, that tends to drag the absolute number of jobs along with it. But other percentage flingers are not so careful. In June 2011, the Republican Party of Wisconsin issued a news release touting the job-creating record of Governor Scott Walker. It had been another weak month for the U.S. economy as a whole, which added only 18,000 jobs nationally. But the state employment numbers look much better, a net increase of 9,500 jobs. Today, the statement read, we learned that over 50% of U.S. job growth in June came from our state. The talking point was picked up and distributed by GOP politicians like Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, who told an audience in a Milwaukee suburb, the labor report that came out last week had an anemic 18,000 created in this country, but half of them came here in Wisconsin. Something we are doing here must be working. This is a perfect example of the soup you get into when you start reporting percentages of numbers like net job gains that might be either positive or negative. Wisconsin added 9,500 jobs, which is good. But neighboring Minnesota, under Democratic Governor Mark Dayton, added more than 13,000 in the same month. Texas, California, Michigan, and Massachusetts also outpaced Wisconsin's job gains. Wisconsin had a good month, that's true, but it didn't contribute as many jobs as the rest of the country put together, as the Republican messaging suggested. In fact, what was going on is that job losses in other states almost exactly balanced out the jobs created in places like Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and Texas. That's how Wisconsin's governor could claim his state accounted for half the nation's job growth, and Minnesota's governor, if he'd cared to, could have said that his own state was responsible for 70% of it, and they could both, in this technically correct but fundamentally misleading way, be right. Or take a recent New York Times op-ed by Stephen Ratner, which used the work of economists Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez to argue that the current economic recovery is unequally distributed among Americans. New statistics show an ever more startling divergence between the fortunes of the wealthy and everybody else, and the desperate need to address this wrenching problem. Even in a country that sometimes seems inured to income inequality, these takeaways are truly stunning. In 2010, as the nation continued to recover from the recession, a dizzying 93% of the additional income created in the country that year, compared to 2009, $288 billion, went to the top 1% of taxpayers, those with at least $352,000 in income. The bottom 99% received a microscopic $80 increase in pay per person in 2010, after adjusting for inflation. The top 1%, whose average income is $1,019,089, had an 11.6% increase in income. The article comes packaged with a handsome infographic that breaks the income gains up even further. 37% to the ultra-rich members of the top 0.01%, with 56% to the rest of the top 1%, leaving a meager 7% for the remaining 99% of the population. Now let's slice the pie one more time and ask about the people who are in the top 10% but not the top 1%. Here you've got the family doctors, the non-elite lawyers, the engineers, and the upper-middle managers. How big is their slice? You can get this from Piketty and Saez's data, which they've helpfully put online. And you find something curious. This group of Americans had an average income of about $159,000 in 2009, which increased to a little over $161,000 in 2010. That's a modest gain compared to what the richest percentile racked up, but it still accounts for 17% of the total income gained between 2010 and 2011. Try to fit a 17% slice of the pie in with a 93% share held by the 1%ers, and you find you've got more pie than plate. 93% and 17% add up to more than 100%. How does this make sense? It makes sense because the bottom 90% actually had lower average income in 2011 than they did in 2010, recovery or no recovery. Negative numbers in the mix make percentages act wonky. Looking at the Piketty-Saez data for different years, you see the same pattern again and again. In 1992, 131% of the national gains in income were accrued by the top 1% of earners. That's certainly an impressive figure, but one which clearly indicates that the percentage doesn't mean quite what you're used to it meaning. You can't put 131% in a pie chart. Between 1982 and 1983, as another recession retreated into memory, 91% of the national income gain went to the 10% but not 1% group. Does that mean that the recovery was captured by the reasonably wealthy professionals, leaving the middle class and the very rich behind? Nope. The top 1% saw a healthy increase that year too, accounting for 63% of the national income gain all by themselves. What was really going on then, as now, was that the bottom 90% continued to lose ground while the situation brightened for everybody else. None of which is to deny that morning in America comes a little earlier in the day for the richest Americans than it does for the middle class. But it does put a slightly different spin on the story. It's not that the 1% are benefiting while the rest of America languishes. The people in the top 10% but not the top 1%, a group that includes, not to put too fine a point on it, many readers of the New York Times opinion page, are doing fine too, capturing more than twice as much as the 7% share that the pie chart appears to allow them. It's the other 90% of the country whose tunnel still looks dark at the end. Even when the numbers involved happen to be positive, there's room for spinners to tell a misleading story about percentages. In April 2012, Mitt Romney's presidential campaign, facing poor poll numbers among women voters, released a statement asserting, "The Obama administration has brought hard times to American women." Under President Obama, more women have struggled to find work than at any other time in recorded history. Women account for 92.3% of all jobs lost under Obama. That statement is, in a manner of speaking, correct. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, total employment in January 2009 was 133,561,000, and in March 2012, just 132,821,000, a net loss of 740,000 jobs. Among women, the numbers were 66,122,000 and 65,439,000. So 683,000 fewer women were employed in March 2012 than in January 2009 when Obama took office. Divide the second number by the first, and you get the 92% figure. It's almost as if President Obama had been going around ordering businesses to fire all the women. But no, those numbers are net job losses. We have no idea how many jobs were created and how many destroyed over the three-year period, only that the difference of those two numbers is 740,000. The net job loss is positive sometimes and negative other times, which is why taking percentages of it is a dangerous business. Just imagine what would have happened if the Romney campaign had started their count 1 month later, in February 2009. At that point, another brutal month into the recession, total employment was down to 132,837,000. Between then and March 2012, the economy suffered a net loss of just 16,000 jobs. Among women alone, the jobs lost were 484,000, balanced, of course, by a corresponding gain for men. What a missed opportunity for the Romney campaign. If they'd started their reckoning in February, the first full month of the Obama presidency, they could have pointed out that women accounted for over 3,000% of all jobs lost on Obama's watch. But that would have signaled to any but the thickest voters that this percentage was somehow not the right measure. What actually happened to men and women in the workforce between Obama's inauguration and March 2012? Two things. Between January 2009 and February 2010, employment plunged for both men and women as the recession and its aftermath took their toll. And then, post-recession, the employment picture started slowly improving. During the steep decline, men took it on the chin, suffering almost twice as many job losses as women. And in the recovery, men account for 75% of the jobs gained. When you add both periods together, the men's figures happen to cancel out almost exactly, leaving them with about as many jobs at the end as the beginning. But the idea that the current economic period has been almost exclusively bad for women is badly misguided. The Washington Post graded the Romney campaign's 92.3% figure as true but false. That classification drew mockery by Romney supporters, but I think it's just right and has something deep to say about the use of numbers in politics. There's no question about the accuracy of the number. You divide the net jobs lost by women by the net jobs lost, and you get 92.3%. But that makes the claim true only in a very weak sense. It's as if the Obama campaign had released a statement saying, Mitt Romney has never denied allegations that for years he's operated a bicontinental cocaine trafficking ring in Colombia and Salt Lake City. That statement is also 100% true, but it's designed to create a false impression. So true but false is a pretty fair assessment. It's the right answer to the wrong question, which makes it worse in a way than a plain miscalculation. It's easy to think of the quantitative analysis of policy as something you do with a calculator, but the calculator only enters once you've figured out what calculation you want to do. I blame word problems. They give a badly wrong impression of the relation between mathematics and reality. Bobby has 300 marbles and gives 30% of them to Jenny. He gives half as many to Jimmy as he gave to Jenny. How many does he have left? That looks like it's about the real world, but it's just an arithmetic problem in a not very convincing disguise. The word problem has nothing to do with marbles. It might as well just say, type 300 minus 0.3 times 300 minus 0.3 times 300 over 2 equals into your calculator and copy down the answer. But real-world questions aren't like word problems. A real-world problem is something like, has the recession and its aftermath been especially bad for women in the workforce? And if so, to what extent is this the result of Obama administration policies? Your calculator doesn't have a button for this. Because in order to give a sensible answer, you need to know more than just numbers. What shape do the job loss curves for men and women have in a typical recession? Was this recession notably different in that respect? What kind of jobs are disproportionately held by women, and what decisions has Obama made that affect that sector of the economy? It's only after you've started to formulate these questions that you take out the calculator. But at that point, the real mental work is already finished. Dividing one number by another is mere computation. Figuring out what you should divide by what is mathematics. Part 2. Inference. Includes hidden messages in the Torah, the dangers of wiggle room, null hypothesis significance testing, B.F. Skinner versus William Shakespeare, turbo sexophonic delight, the clumpiness of prime numbers, torturing the data until it confesses, the right way to teach creationism in public schools. Chapter 6. The Baltimore Stockbroker and the Bible Code. People use mathematics to get a handle on problems ranging from the everyday, how long should I expect to wait for the next bus, to the cosmic, what did the universe look like 3 trillionths of a second after the Big Bang? But there's a realm of questions out beyond cosmic, questions about the meaning and origin of it all, questions you might think mathematics could have no purchase on. Never underestimate the territorial ambitions of mathematics. You want to know about God? There are mathematicians on the case. The idea that earthly humans can learn about the divine world by rational observation is a very old one, as old, according to the 12th century Jewish scholar Maimonides, as monotheism itself. Maimonides' central work, the Mishneh Torah, gives this account of Abraham's revelation. After Abraham was weaned, while still an infant, his mind began to reflect. By day and by night, he was thinking and wondering, how is it possible that this celestial sphere should continuously be guiding the world and have no one to guide it and cause it to turn round? For it cannot be that it turns round of itself. His mind was busily working and reflecting until he had attained the way of truth, apprehended the correct line of thought, and knew that there is one God, that he guides the celestial sphere and created everything, and that among all that exist there is no God besides him. He then began to proclaim to the whole world with great power and to instruct the people that the entire universe had but one creator and that him it was right to worship. When the people flocked to him and questioned him regarding his assertions, he would instruct each one according to his capacity till he had brought him to the way of truth, and thus thousands and tens of thousands joined him. This vision of religious belief is extremely congenial to the mathematical mind. You believe in God not because you were touched by an angel, not because your heart opened up one day and let the sunshine in, and certainly not because of something your parents told you, but because God is a thing that must be, as surely as 8 times 6 must be the same as 6 times 8. Nowadays, the Abrahamic argument, just look at everything, how could it all be so awesome if there weren't a designer behind it, has been judged wanting, at least in most scientific circles. But then again, now we have microscopes and telescopes and computers. We are not restricted to gaping at the moon from our cribs. We have data, lots of data, and we have the tools to mess with it. The favorite data set of the rabbinical scholar is the Torah, which is, after all, a sequentially arranged string of characters drawn from a finite alphabet, which we attempt faithfully to transmit without error from synagogue to synagogue. Despite being written on parchment, it's the original digital signal. And when a group of researchers at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem started analyzing that signal in the mid-1990s, they found something very strange, or, depending on your theological perspective, not strange at all. The researchers came from different disciplines. Eliyahu Rips was a senior professor of mathematics, a well-known group theorist. Yoav Rosenberg, a graduate student in computer science. And Daron Vitstum, a former student with a master's degree in physics. But all shared a taste for the strand of Torah study that searches for esoteric texts hidden beneath the stories, genealogies, and admonitions that make up the Torah's surface. Their tool of choice was the equidistant letter sequence, henceforth ELS, a string of text obtained by plucking characters from the Torah at regular intervals. For example, in the phrase, "Don your braces askew," you can read every fifth letter, starting from the first, to get D, U, C, K. So the ELS would be duck, whether as warning or waterfowl identification, to be determined from context. Most ELSs don't spell words. If I make an ELS out of every third letter in the sentence you're reading, I get gibberish like mtsoslo, which is more typical. Still, the Torah is a long document, and if you look for patterns, you'll find them. As a mode of religious inquiry, this seems strange at first. Is the God of the Old Testament really the kind of deity who signals his presence by showing up in a word search? In the Torah, when God wants you to know he's there, you know. 90-year-old women get pregnant, bushes catch fire and talk, dinner falls from the sky. Still, Rips, Wittstum, and Rosenberg were not the first to look for messages concealed in the ELSs of the Torah. There's some sporadic precedent among the classical rabbis, but the method was really pioneered in the 20th century by Michael Dov Weissmandl, a rabbi in Slovakia who spent World War II trying, largely in vain, to raise enough money from the West to buy respite for Slovakia's Jews from bribable German officials. Weissmandl found several interesting ELSs in the Torah. Most famously, he observed that starting from a certain mem, the Hebrew letter that sounds like M, in the Torah, and counting forward in steps of 50 letters, you found the sequence mem, shin, nun, he, which spells out the Hebrew word mishneh, the first word of the title of Maimonides' Torah commentary. Now you skip forward 613 letters. Why 613? Because that's the exact number of commandments in the Torah, and start counting every 50th letter again. You find that the letters spell out Torah. In other words, that the title of Maimonides' book is recorded in ELS form in the Torah, a document set down more than 1,000 years before his birth. Like I said, the Torah is a long document. By one count, it has 304,805 letters in all. So it's not clear what to make, if anything, from patterns like the one Weissmandl found. There are lots of ways to slice and dice the Torah, and inevitably, some of them are going to spell out words. Wittstum, Rips, and Rosenberg, mathematically as well as religiously trained, set themselves a more systematic task. They chose 32 notable rabbis from the whole span of modern Jewish history, from Avraham HaMalach to the Ya'abez. In Hebrew, numbers can be recorded in alphabetic characters, so the birth and death dates of the rabbis provided more letter sequences to play with. So the question is, do the names of the rabbis appear in equidistant letter sequences unusually close to their birth and death dates? Or, more provocatively, did the Torah know the future? Wittstum and his colleagues tested this hypothesis in a clever way. First, they searched the book of Genesis for ELSs spelling out the rabbis' names and dates, and computed how close in the text the sequences yielding the names were to the ones yielding the corresponding dates. Then, they shuffled the 32 dates, so that each one was now matched with a random rabbi, and they ran the test again. Then they did the same thing a million times. If there were no relation in the Torah's text between the names of the rabbis and the corresponding dates, you'd expect the true matching between rabbis and dates to do about as well as one of the random shuffles. That's not what they found. The correct association ended up very near the top of the rankings, notching the 453rd highest score among the 1 million contenders. They tried the same thing with other texts, War and Peace, the Book of Isaiah, part of Scripture, but not the part that God is understood to have written, and a version of Genesis with the letters scrambled up at random. In all these cases, the real rabbinical birthdays stayed in the middle of the pack. The author's conclusion, written with characteristic mathematical sobriety, we conclude that the proximity of ELSs with related meanings in the Book of Genesis is not due to chance. Despite the quiet language, this was understood to be a startling finding, made more so by the mathematical credentials of the authors, especially Rips. The paper was refereed and published in 1994 in the journal Statistical Science, accompanied by an unusual preface by editor Robert E. Cass, who wrote, "Our referees were baffled. Their prior beliefs made them think the Book of Genesis could not possibly contain meaningful references to modern-day individuals. Yet when the authors carried out additional analyses and checks, the effect persisted. The paper is thus offered to statistical science readers as a challenging puzzle." Despite its startling findings, the Wittstum paper didn't immediately draw a lot of public attention. All that changed when the American journalist Michael Drosnin got wind of the paper. Drosnin went hunting for ELSs of his own, jettisoning scientific restraint and counting every cluster of sequences he could find as a divine foretelling of future events. In 1997, he published a book, The Bible Code, whose cover features a faded, ancient-looking Torah scroll with circled sequences of letters spelling out the Hebrew words for Yitzhak Rabin and assassin who will assassinate. Drosnin's claims to have warned Rabin of his 1995 assassination a year in advance were a potent advertisement for his book, which also features Torah-certified predictions of the Gulf War and the 1994 collision of comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 with Jupiter. Fitzdome, Rips, and Rosenberg denounced Drosnin's ad hoc method, but Death and Prophecy move units. The Bible Code was a bestseller. Drosnin appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show and CNN and had personal audiences with Yasser Arafat, Shimon Peres, and Clinton Chief of Staff John Podesta, during which he shared his theories about the upcoming end of days, which was supposed to happen, by the way, in 2006, so few, I guess. Millions saw what looked like mathematical proof that the Bible was the Word of God. Modern people with a scientific worldview were presented with an unexpected avenue toward accepting religious faith, and many took it. I have it on good assurance that one new father from a secular Jewish family waited until the statistical science paper was officially accepted before deciding to circumcise his son. For the kid's sake, I hope the refereeing process was on the speedy side. But just as the codes were drawing wide acceptance in public, their foundations were coming under attack in the mathematical world. The controversy was especially bitter among the large community of Orthodox Jewish mathematicians. The Harvard Math Department, where I was a PhD student at the time, had on the faculty both David Kajdan, who had expressed a modest openness to the codes, and Shlomo Sternberg, a vocal opponent who thought promotion of the codes made the Orthodox look like dupes and fools. Sternberg launched a broadside in the notices of the American Mathematical Society, in which he called the Wittstum Rips Rosenberg paper a hoax and said that Kajdan and others with similar views have not only brought shame on themselves, they have disgraced mathematics. The math department afternoon tea was kind of awkward the day Sternberg's article came out, let me tell you. Religious scholars, too, were resistant to the lure of the codes. Some, like the leaders of the yeshiva Eish HaTorah, embraced the codes as a means of drawing unobservant Jews back into a more rigorous version of the faith. Others were suspicious of a mechanism that represented a sharp break from conventional Torah study. I heard of one distinguished rabbi who, at the end of a long and traditionally boozy Purim dinner, asked one of his guests, a code adherent, "So tell me, what would you do if you found a code in the Torah that said the Sabbath was supposed to be on Sunday?" "There wouldn't be such a code," the colleague said, "because God commanded that the Sabbath is on Saturday." The old rabbi didn't give up. "Okay," he said, "but what if there were?" The young colleague was silent for a time and finally said, "Then I guess I'd have to think about it." At this point, the rabbi determined that the codes were to be rejected, for while there is indeed a Jewish tradition, particularly among rabbis with mystical leanings, of carrying out numerical analysis of the letters of the Torah, the process is meant only to aid in understanding and appreciating the Holy Book. If the method could be used, even in principle, to induce doubt as to the basic laws of the faith, it was about as authentically Jewish as a bacon cheeseburger. Why did mathematicians reject what seemed plain evidence of the Torah's divine inspiration? To explain, we need to introduce a new character, the Baltimore Stockbroker. The Baltimore Stockbroker. Here's a parable. One day, you receive an unsolicited newsletter from a stockbroker in Baltimore containing a tip that a certain stock is due for a big rise. A week passes, and just as the Baltimore stockbroker predicted, the stock goes up. The next week, you get a new edition of the newsletter, and this time, the tip is about a stock whose price the broker thinks is going to fall. And indeed, the stock craters. 10 weeks go by, each one bringing a new issue of the mysterious newsletter with a new prediction, and each time, the prediction comes true. On the 11th week, you get a solicitation to invest money with the Baltimore stockbroker, naturally with a hefty commission to cover the keen view of the market so amply demonstrated by the newsletter's 10-week run of golden picks. Sounds like a pretty good deal, right? Surely the Baltimore stockbroker is onto something. It seems incredibly unlikely that a complete duffer with no special knowledge about the market would get 10 up or down predictions in a row correct. In fact, you can compute the odds on the nose. If the duffer has a 50% chance of getting each prediction right, then the chance of his getting the first two predictions right is half of half, or a quarter. His chance of getting the first three right is half of that quarter, or an eighth, and so on. Continuing this computation, his chance of hitting the mark 10 times in a row is a half times 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 a half, or 1 in 1,024. In other words, the chance that a duffer would do so well is next to nil. But things look different when you retell the story from the Baltimore stockbroker's point of view. Here's what you didn't see the first time. That first week, you weren't the only person who got the broker's newsletter. He sent out 10,240. But the newsletters weren't all the same. Half of them were like yours, predicting a rise in the stock. The others predicted exactly the opposite. The 5,120 people who got a dud prediction from the stockbroker never heard from him again. But you and the 5,119 other people who got your version of the newsletter get another tip next week. Of those 5,120 newsletters, half say what yours said and half say the opposite. And after that week, there are still 2,560 people who received two correct predictions in a row. And so on. After the 10th week, there are going to be 10 lucky people who've gotten 10 straight winning picks from the Baltimore stockbroker, no matter what the stock market does. The broker might be an eagle-eyed observer of the market, or he might pick stocks by slapping chicken guts against the wall and reading the stains. Either way, there are 10 newsletter recipients out there to whom he looks like a genius, 10 people from whom he can expect to collect substantial fees, 10 people for whom past performance is going to be no guarantee of future results. I've often heard the Baltimore stockbroker parable told as a true story, but I couldn't locate any evidence that it's ever really happened. The closest thing I found was a 2008 reality TV show, reality TV being where we go for parables nowadays, in which British magician Darren Brown pulled off a similar stunt, mailing various horse racing picks to thousands of Britons with the result of eventually convincing a single person that he'd devised a foolproof prediction system. Brown, who likes dispelling mystical claims more than he does promoting them, exposed the mechanism of the trick at the end of the show, probably doing more for math education in the UK than a dozen sober BBC specials. But if you tweak the game, making it less clearly fraudulent but leaving unchanged the potential to mislead, you find the Baltimore stockbroker is alive and well in the financial industry. When a company launches a mutual fund, they often maintain the fund in-house for some time before opening it to the public, a practice called incubation. The life of an incubated fund is not as warm and safe as the name might suggest. Typically, companies incubate lots of funds at once, experimenting with numerous investment strategies and allocations. The funds jostle and compete in the womb. Some show handsome returns and are quickly made available to the public with extensive documentation of their earnings so far. But the runts of the litter are mercy-killed, often without any public notice that they ever existed. Now, it might be that the mutual funds that make it out of the incubator did so because they actually represented smarter investments. The companies selling the mutual funds may even believe that. Who doesn't, when a gamble goes right, think their own smarts and know-how are in some way due the credit? But the data suggests the opposite. The incubator funds, once the public gets their hands on them, don't maintain their excellent prenatal performance, instead offering roughly the same returns as the median fund. What does this mean for you if you're fortunate enough to have some money to invest? It means you're best off resisting the lure of the hot new fund that made 10% over the last 12 months. Better to follow the deeply unsexy advice you're probably sick of hearing, to eat your vegetables and take the stairs of financial planning. Instead of hunting for a magic system or an advisor with a golden touch, put your money in a big, dull, low-fee index fund and forget about it. When you sink your savings into the incubated fund with the eye-popping returns, you are like the newsletter getter who invests his life savings with the Baltimore stockbroker. You've been swayed by the impressive results, but you don't know how many chances the broker had to get those results. It's a lot like playing Scrabble with my 8-year-old son. If he's unsatisfied with the letters he pulls from the bag, he dumps them back in and draws again, repeating this process until he gets letters he likes. In his view, this is perfectly fair. After all, he's closing his eyes, so he has no way of knowing what letters he's going to draw. But if you give yourself enough chances, you'll eventually come across that Z you're waiting for, and it's not because you're lucky, it's because you're cheating. The Baltimore Stockbroker con works because, like all good magic tricks, it doesn't try to fool you outright. That is, it doesn't try to tell you something false. Rather, it tells you something true from which you're likely to draw incorrect conclusions. It really is improbable that 10 stock picks in a row would come out the right way, or that a magician who bet on 6 horse races would get the winner right every time, or that a mutual fund would beat the market by 10%. The mistake is in being surprised by this encounter with the improbable. The universe is big, and if you're sufficiently attuned to amazingly improbable occurrences, you'll find them. Improbable things happen a lot. It's massively improbable to get hit by a lightning bolt or to win the lottery. But these things happen to people all the time, because there are a lot of people in the world, and a lot of them buy lottery tickets or go golfing in a thunderstorm or both. Most coincidences lose their snap when viewed from the appropriate distance. On July 9th, 2007, the North Carolina Cash 5 lottery numbers came up 4, 21, 23, 34, 39. 2 days later, the same 5 numbers came up again. That seems highly unlikely, and it seems that way because it is. The chance of those 2 lottery draws matching by pure chance was tiny, less than 2 in a million. But that's not the relevant question if you're deciding how impressed to be. After all, the Cash 5 game had already been going on for almost a year, offering many opportunities for coincidence. It turns out, the chance that some 3-day period would have seen 2 identical Cash 5 draws was a much less miraculous 1 in 1,000. And Cash 5 isn't the only game in town. There are hundreds of 5-number lottery games running all over the country, and have been for years. When you put them all together, it's not at all surprising that you get a coincidence like 2 identical draws in 3 days. That doesn't make each individual coincidence any less improbable, but here comes the chorus again, improbable things happen a lot. Aristotle, as usual, was here first. Despite lacking any formal notion of probability, he wrote, "It is probable that improbable things will happen." Granted this, one might argue that what is improbable is probable. Once you've truly absorbed this fundamental truth, the Baltimore stockbroker has no power over you. That the stockbroker handed you 10 straight good stock picks is very unlikely. That he handed somebody such a good run of picks, given 10,000 chances, is not even remotely surprising. In the British statistician R.A. Fisher's famous formulation, the 1 chance in a million will undoubtedly occur, with no less and no more than its appropriate frequency, however surprised we may be that it should occur to us. Wiggle Room and the Names of the Rabbis. The Bible decoders didn't write 10,000 versions of their paper and send them to 10,000 statistical journals. So it's hard to see, at first, how their story resembles the Baltimore stockbroker con. But when mathematicians took up the challenge Cass had posed in his journal preface, looking for some explanation other than God did it for the Bible code results, they found the matter wasn't as simple as Wittstum and company had made it seem. The pace was set by Brendan McKay, an Australian computer scientist, and Dror Bar-Natan, an Israeli mathematician then at Hebrew University. They made the critical point that medieval rabbis didn't have passports or birth certificates granting them official names. They were referred to by appellations, and different authors might denote the same rabbi in different ways. If Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson were a famous rabbi, for example, would you look for a prediction of his birth in the Torah under Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson, DTR Johnson, or all of these? This ambiguity creates some wiggle room for code hunters. Consider Rabbi Avraham ben Dov Ber Friedman, an 18th century Hasidic mystic who lived and worked in the shtetl of Fastov in Ukraine. Wittstum, Ritz, and Rosenberg used Rabbi Avraham and Hamalach, the angel, as appellations. But why, McKay and Bar-Natan ask, do they use Hamalach alone, but not Rabbi Avraham Hamalach, a name by which the Rebbe was also often known? McKay and Barnaton found that wiggle room in the choices of names led to drastic changes in the quality of the results. They made a different set of choices about the appellations of the rabbis. Their choices, according to biblical scholars, make just as much sense as the ones picked by Wittstum. One rabbi called the two lists of names equally appalling. And they found that with the new list of names, something quite amazing transpired. The Torah no longer seemed to detect the birth and death dates of the rabbinic notables. But the Hebrew edition of War and Peace nailed it, identifying the rabbis with their correct dates about as well as the Book of Genesis did in the Wittstum paper. What can this mean? Not, I hurry to say, that Leo Tolstoy composed his novel with the names of rabbis concealed therein, designed to be uncovered only once modern Hebrew was developed and classic works of world literature translated into it. Rather, McKay and Barnaton are making a potent point about the power of wiggle room. Wiggle room is what the Baltimore stockbroker has when he gives himself plenty of chances to win. Wiggle room is what the mutual fund company has when it decides which of its secretly incubating funds are winners and which are trash. Wiggle room is what McKay and Barnaton used to work up a list of rabbinical names that jibed well with War and Peace. When you're trying to draw reliable inferences from improbable events, wiggle room is the enemy. In a later paper, McKay and Barnaton asked Simcha Emanuel, a Talmud professor then at the University of Tel Aviv, to draw up another list of appellations, this one not designed for compatibility with either the Torah or War and Peace. On this list, the Torah did only a little better than chance. How Tolstoy did is left unreported. It is very unlikely that any given set of rabbinic appellations is well matched to birth and death dates in the Book of Genesis, but with so many ways of choosing the names, it's not at all improbable that among all the choices there would be one that made the Torah look uncannily prescient. Given enough chances, finding codes is a cinch. It's especially easy if you use Michael Drosnin's less scientific approach to code finding. Drosnin said of code skeptics, "When my critics find a message about the assassination of a prime minister encrypted in Moby Dick, I'll believe them." McKay quickly found equidistant letter sequences in Moby Dick, referring to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, Indira Gandhi, Leon Trotsky, and, for good measure, Drosnin himself. As I write this, Drosnin remains alive and well, despite the prophecy. He is on his third Bible code book, the last of which he advertised by taking out a full-page ad in a December 2010 edition of the New York Times, warning President Obama that, according to letter sequences hidden in scripture, Osama bin Laden might already have a nuclear weapon. Wittstum, Rips, and Rosenberg insist they weren't like the masters of the incubator funds, displaying to the public only the experiments that gave the best possible results. Their precise list of names was chosen in advance, they say, before running any tests. And that may well be true. But even if it is, it casts the miraculous success of the Bible codes in a very different light. That the Torah, like War and Peace, can successfully be mined for some version of the rabbis' names is not surprising. The miracle, if there is one, is that Wittstum and his colleagues were moved to choose precisely those versions of the names on which the Torah scores best. There's one loose end that should trouble you, though. McKay and Barnaton made a compelling case that the wiggle room in the design of Wittstum's experiment was enough to explain the Bible codes. But the Wittstum paper was carried out using standard statistical tests, the same ones scientists use to judge claims about everything from medicines to economic policies. It wouldn't have been accepted in statistical science otherwise. If the paper passed that test, shouldn't we have accepted its conclusions, however otherworldly they may have seemed? Or, to put it another way, if we now feel comfortable rejecting the conclusions of the Wittstum study, what does that say about the reliability of our standard statistical tests? It says you ought to be a little worried about them. And it turns out that, without any input from the Torah, scientists and statisticians have already been worrying about them for quite some time. Chapter 7. Dead fish don't read minds. Because here's the thing. The Bible code kerfuffle is not the only occasion on which the standard statistical toolkit has been used to derive a result that sounds like magic. One of the hottest topics in medical science is functional neuroimaging, which promises to let scientists see your thoughts and feelings flickering across your synapses in real time through ever more accurate sensors. At the 2009 Organization for Human Brain Mapping Conference in San Francisco, UC Santa Barbara neuroscientist Craig Bennett presented a poster called Neural